Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin with my wake-up call, and we are back at the beginning of another very difficult week in both the economy and the financial markets. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to start with a piece of advice. Now, I have told you that I would not shrink from telling you when I thought you needed to take some drastic measures, and indeed, I am going to put that very statement to the test today, and it concerns a select few of you. You may remember that I have advised you all to put your money in your 401k plans into the money market fund, and I have suggested very strongly that you should work tirelessly to try to get a treasury money market fund added to the menu of choices in your 401k. Some of you have done so, some of those who have done so have been successful, and of course some of you have not. And among those who have not are people who do not even have any kind of money market fund. They have what is known as a stable value fund in their portfolios. Now, money market funds which are commercial money market funds, which is to say that they are not treasury money market funds, are more dangerous than the treasury money market funds. And for the time being, I think that we can stay with them until further notice. However, the time has come, ladies and gentlemen, for me to attack directly the stable value funds. Now, as you know, there are a number of choices in money market funds. There are some stock choices, some bond choices, and then usually some kind of cash equivalent, or what they euphemistically call a cash equivalent, of which I maintain that the only acceptable cash equivalent is a treasury money market fund. But some of you don't have this. You only have a stable value fund, which is supposed to mimic a money market fund. It doesn't. It never has, and it never will, because it's rather a complicated phenomenon, a stable value fund. It is supposed to keep the basic unit stable at a given figure, and then you receive interest on that, very much like in the case of a money market fund. But they are, in fact, complicated investments based on insurance contracts, which, of course, has nothing whatever to do with money markets. And I've had a problem with stable value funds. I've been watching them, and they sort of seem to be okay for the time being. But given the insurance market and what's going on in the financial world, I have now got to make a painful recommendation. Now, this is to say you can't buy stocks, so that takes away all the stocks out of the equation. You can't buy bonds, because I think the bond market is going to collapse. It's already in the process of falling quite sharply. And if you cannot buy any type of money market fund, and you're left with a stable market value, I am left with the really very painful and very onerous responsibility, ladies and gentlemen, of having for the very first time to recommend that those with stable value funds must, in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, I stress this is not the opinion of the financial community at large, far from it, I must tell you regretfully that I think you need to cancel your contributions to your 401k and sell out your 401k plan, paying the penalty and paying the interest, I mean the tax. And this is going to put you to quite a large bite into that fund. I say this in all seriousness, ladies and gentlemen. I had hoped it would never come to this. But I am afraid that we are looking at serious problems now which could attack the stable value funds. I'm going to read a very short article by David Merkel, who is an economist, but I followed, he's a very much of a mainstream economist, so that makes his opinion all that more important. He writes for Real Money, which is a paying subscription service of thestreet.com, and he is very much of an expert on stable value funds, and he's written several articles about them, and there's one that just came out, and I'm going to read it to you, and then after that, it is up to each and every one of you to make your decision as to what you want to do. This is what he has to say. There's a lot that I don't know here, but what I do know concerns me. Stable value funds are a murky part of the market. They are murky because they don't report the value of the underlying assets, but only the smoothed value of assets and the rate that they are currently crediting. Note that I wrote this piece at Real Money called The Biggest Asset Class You Never Heard Of, which was about stable value funds. I have debated as to whether I should write a piece like this, but at this point I figure that someone will eventually point this out, so better for me to do it than for it to come from another quarter. Let's start with the question, how does a stable value manager manage the fund? In the old days, it meant buying guaranteed investment contracts, GICs, from insurance companies and buying the highest rate offered because they were all AAA in the late 80s. Even before defaults happened, the stable value funds found that there was not enough capacity in the insurance industry to write GICs at reasonable rates. As a result, they began buying AAA assets in the structured products markets and purchased wrap agreements that allowed those assets to be carried at book value rather than market value. The difference is this. Book value is for savers. Just take their deposit and credit interest to them. No volatility. That's the beauty of stable value. It seemingly eliminates the volatility of the markets and lets savers be savers. But what is going on under the hood? Many AAA asset classes have done poorly in the recent past, and I'm not talking about CDOs. Stable value funds have an average maturity of around 2 years. If I look at AAA asset-backed, commercial mortgage-backed, or corporate securities in the two-year maturity bucket, I see dollar prices that average around $90. Stable value funds may have $90 of assets at current market value backing $100 of book value. This is not a stable situation. No joke intended. If I were in this situation, I would move all of my money to the most stable option in my DC plan that I could because of the possibility of a run on the fund. Now, if few withdraw on net after 2 to 3 years, this situation will likely resolve itself. But who can rely on the intelligence of other fund holders? This is like the prisoner's dilemma, where he can act and get something, harming others in the process, or get harmed himself. Consider your own needs here. My own view is that we will see failures of stable value funds within 2009. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well now, again, this comes from David Merkel. If you want to, if those of you who have stable market funds want to Google him, the name is M-E-R-K-E-L, David Merkel. And I suggest you put David Merkel and stable value funds, and several articles will come up, and you will at least see that this man is an expert in that regard. I'm sorry that it's come to this, but I can no longer, in all conscience, hope that everything is going to be okay in that regard. For those of you with commercial money market funds, you may stay a while longer, but I fear that I will be issuing the same kind of advice to you down the line. All right. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and the toll-free number to call if you are interested in asking a question on the air would be 888-873-4643. Now, I do urge you to do this. We really, really, really do like you to ask your questions. And so please do so, come at me with whatever you need to talk about, and we'll try and help you out. Again, the number is 888-873-4643. If you have cold feet and you would rather email your questions, you may do that too. My email inbox is open full time, so I can see it at a glance. The email address is rmartin@lataminv.com. Lataminv is LATAMINV, which is kind of short for Latin American Investments, but Lataminv will do it for you. Once again, the email address is rmartin@lataminv.com. And finally, my personal number, my direct line, if you would like to ask me a question about your finances and other personal information, you may do that too, calling my number in Miami, 305-579-2012. Once more, 305-579-2012. All right, well, now just a quick word about next week. I will be absent on Monday and Thursday. I will be abroad on business. I'm going to ask Ryan as nicely as I possibly can if he would be prepared to record two shows for me, in which case you will have two shows to listen to, two new shows, and I will be back the following Monday, and I will, of course, be here on Thursday, this Thursday as well. Okay? All right, hands up those of you who watched Idiocracy this weekend. I did. I had not expected to last more than 10 minutes. It was the Comedy Channel, and the Comedy Channel is not known for its erudite renditions, but, well, it was, I thought, a very powerful movie, as a matter of fact. It explained, actually, what happens to a society that dumbs itself down, not unlike one currently to be found in the United States of America, where every aspect of life is and has been dumbed down for many, many years, and what this looks like in 500 years' time, in a society which continues to disintegrate and degenerate at the current rate. And it involves two people, two very simple, very dumb people who have been frozen in time and wake up 500 years ahead to find themselves the most intelligent beings in the United States. It's very amusing, and none other than Steve Kruger wrote in to say that he indeed had watched it. And Steve says as follows, Richard, I am forever grateful for you. Oh, by the way, if any of you would like to call in, why don't you call in right now and give your opinion if any of you have seen it or have seen it in the past? I'd love to hear your views on it. It's actually, I think, well worth a little discussion here. So please call. The number is 888-873-4643. That's if you'd like to call in and discuss Idiocracy. Steve has this to say. Richard, I am forever grateful for you guiding me to what is without a doubt one of the finest movies ever made. It is right up there with Gone with the Wind, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and Kung Fu Panda. If there is any doubt in anyone's mind that a democratic republic is not a self-perpetuating governing process and that it requires daily attention like a garden, this movie makes it clear. When you take your hands off the wheel, you crash, giving us what we have today. Idiocracy brings to light what I have said for years. Public schools, low voter turnout, a generally complacent public will lead us into idiocracy. We will not have to wait 500 years, as we are on fast track. Our best years are, I am sad to say, behind us. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve. We have George from New York on standby, and in addition, Ryan tells me that the events in that movie are likely to occur. Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I would tend to... Oh, it's Alex back again. I'm getting so confused these days. Ryan started out, now it's Alex. Well, Alex, thank you very much for the contribution, and let's hear from George.
Hi, Richard. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm sorry to hear your commentary this before. It's very bad times. A friend of mine has money in an annuity fund, and it guarantees her payment for the rest of her life at a certain age. My question to you, is there a built-in out for them? Because if they pay her and their stocks drive, they go bankrupt. If they don't, she's going to sue them. So do they have a built-in out for her?
If they don't pay her and their stock doesn't go to zero, you mean she'll sue them, right?
She'll sue them.
Well, why wouldn't they pay her?
Well, if the market dives and they have their stock goes down with it, and they have no money coming in.
Well, hang on, George. Their ability or otherwise to pay her doesn't depend on the stock price, you know. The stock price is only, it's a casino. The stock price is simply a get-together of buyers and sellers of a stock that represents that company based on what the general public think is going to happen to the company. So just because the stock price goes down doesn't automatically mean that the company won't pay. It just means that people think that at some point the company might go under if it goes that low. I mean, like, you know, Citibank went below $1. It was a penny stock last week for a short while. No, that's not really the issue. The issue is quite simply they will continue to pay her as long as they, as you say, they have money coming in. But if they don't have money coming in and they go bankrupt, they won't pay her. And that's my problem, and that's why I'm not comfortable with annuities right now. I've said, you know, that these annuities are toxic, and, you know, you've got to be very careful. I think insurance companies are next in the firing line. That's my opinion. So I'm not comfortable with annuities. I've had several people ask me about them, and I've suggested that they cash them in. I agree with you on one hand, George, but not because of the stock price, more because that of annuities and their ridiculous bets that they've made on these derivatives that we've talked so much about. That's really where the problem lies. Daryl from the Bronx, can you hear me? Are you online?
Good afternoon, Richard. How are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm so glad to hear you. You just answered two questions that I didn't even have. So if you don't put it in, can I just divert my question to your statement? If you're not doing annuities and you're not doing insurance in order to, oh gosh, what did they call that? I was listening to Ed Slott, and he was talking about putting money in insurance to do something, probably around taxes. Where do you put the money? You answered a question that I didn't even know I had, considering the annuities. If the annuities aren't any good, and I heard Ed Slott talking about insurance policies for protecting money, where do you put the money so that a person who's aged and can't wait for the markets to correct can have a flow of income? Can I ask a follow-up, which was my original question?
Well, but first of all, that's the wrong question.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's a wrong question because it's like saying, if I feel like flying to the moon, what time can I leave? I mean, you know, the question doesn't have an answer because basically there is nothing available for an unreasonable request. I mean, the fact that you may want a certain income doesn't mean that there's necessarily a vehicle out there to provide it for you, Daryl.
Got it. Thank you. I'm clear now. I'm learning more and more every day. Okay, so the question that I originally had was, is there a book or a place online where you can get definitions of the various derivatives? Because I find it challenging trying to explain to people who don't have any clue as to what it is I'm talking about when I'm trying to explain to them that what they're doing is insane.
Okay, the answer to your question, yes. Go to Wikipedia and put in your word, and it will give you a definition. Any of these sort of alphabet soup of derivatives like CDSs, CDOs, LBOs, all these things, all of them can be found in Wikipedia, and you should get a pretty sound and accurate definition out of there, and then you're on your way.
Thank you so much, Richard, and continue putting it out. I've been listening to a lot of Bloomberg Radio lately, and what I'm learning is that markets are way more important than people. And could you comment on, I heard two economists talking about the virtual market, in which people who couldn't get in on the credit default swaps created a virtual.
All right. I will definitely do that, but maybe do that next time. I've got lots of questions. I mean, lots of people are coming in with
Thank
questions.
You so much. Have a blessed day, and have a great
Take
week.
Care,
See you tomorrow.
Take care.
Next week.
Now. Okay. So we have a question right now, and it comes in from Mark Brungs, who says, Dear Richard, can we cancel our 401ks while we still work for the employer we have them with? Should we borrow against them, which takes the money out of the 401k's investments and reinvest more safely? We could then pay back the loans from those investments. You could do that, and some people do that, and especially since you're actually paying yourself back. But my feeling is that it's not wise to do that because you're still in a position of having to invest the money that's in the 401k itself. And so you can't sort of get away. You can only borrow up to 50% of what's in the 401k. So you're still in the problem of having to deal with what's in the 401k, Mark. And you can certainly cancel your 401ks, and you can cash out at any time, even if you're still working for the employer that you have them with. That is absolutely possible. You just can't roll them over into an IRA. That's what you can't do. But you can certainly sell out and leave the fund. We have Steve from Newark online. Hello, Steve.
To say, I like the Idiocracy. I wrote in like last week recommending it to one of your fellow callers. The guy that called in, I think he was a mechanic, talking about how all the new mechanics he's meeting are just less and less talented. And I thought the concept behind the movie was excellent. I thought it was an okay comedy. The director and writer did Office Space, and that's like the main reason I watched it, because that was, to me, a great movie. So.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I obviously, I'm sure that you found certain fault with it, as did I. I thought that they could have made more of the different elements of, you know, being dumb, and they really sort of seem to get fixated on one thing, which was the crop growing problem.
Yeah, they kept going to the Gatorade.
Yeah, but
President Camacho made me laugh.
Yeah, other than for that, I thought it was it made its point. You know, it really did make its point. And my wife, who's American, laughed at some of the turns of speech that I didn't get because I'm not familiar with the cultural. You know, mannerisms of speech that have obviously been played on in the movie. I think if you're American, you get a lot more out of it than I might have. But certainly, it really makes you think. It gives you lots of food for thought.
By the way, it's supposedly the concept's based on a short story which I'd like to read called March of the Morons.
Correct.
I'd like to read that. Have you read it?
No, I haven't. I haven't read it. No, I think probably you should. That's a good point. I actually, when I mentioned the movie last week, I did mention that, and it's certainly something that the listeners should know, that there is a short story called March of the Morons, on which the movie is based. And as Steve says, probably worthwhile reading it.
Excellent.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. All right, bye.
Michi McCabe-Velardi wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. I have my 401k money in the T. Rowe Pice Stable Value Fund, and my employer matches 6% of my contributions. Should I sell what is in there now and continue making contributions so I can continue to get my employer's matching amount?" As a matter of fact, I'm not quite sure how that works, to be honest with you, if you still want to go on contributing after having cashed out. I guess that's possible, and I certainly would advise doing that, Mitchie. Yes, I think you should definitely try to profit from, you know, the free money made available by your employer. So just check with them and find out what the deal is there. But yes, I would do that. Absolutely. Yep. Okay. Now, as all of you know, I'm sort of keeping an eye on elements which I fear are going to lead to a certain amount of civil unrest, which, of course, is something that I've talked about in the past. I have made the point that, as far as I'm concerned, the element of civil unrest is going to come, first of all, in the form of a tax revolt. And I was a little alarmed to read about a recent anti-tax rally in California in which over 15,000 people descended on Fullerton recently to protect higher taxes. That might be an infinitesimally small fraction of the state's 37 million population, but I'm afraid that this kind of trickle frequently does turn into a flood, and I rather think that it won't be long before this happens in California and elsewhere. Just to give you an idea of what did happen in this particular situation, these 15,000 people from all over California descended on downtown Fullerton for the so-called Revolt, Recall, Repeal rally to protest over $50 billion in tax increases in the state of California and to begin a recall effort against the governor and many state legislatures. They were shouting slogans like "off with their heads" and "heads on a stick." Freeway off-ramps heading into Fullerton had to be shut down because so many people were heading to the event and police services were stretched thin. This was organized by John and Ken, radio hosts of KFI 640 AM. They came onto the platform where they hosted the show with a sword and a mask of Governor Schwarzenegger stuck through it. A chant of "heads on a stick" began then and was heard many more times during the three-hour rally radio show. The participants were told to bring DVDs and VHS tapes of Schwarzenegger's movies, which were enthusiastically pummeled by various members of the crowd. They also had a shredder, which they dubbed the Shredinator, which shredded other Schwarzenegger memorabilia. The radio hosts reminded the crowd that Schwarzenegger had promised when running for governor that he would never raise taxes. They played tapes of him repeating this, which got a loud boo from the crowd. The basic feeling was, this has been a complete disaster and it's time to do something about it. He should be apologizing to you and you should be resigning. Well, there you are. I'm not looking forward to more of this, but I rather feel that you're going to see a lot more of it as times come. Tony McConnell sent in an email a couple of weeks ago, and he says he has several little vignettes about different things. Your cousin, he says, "Dear Richard, I think it's always been a characteristic of yours to not speak with absolute certainty and authority." Split infinitive there, Tony, shame on you. "You explain complex economic concepts to the layperson using clear language and reasoning and illustrations from history, and they end up understanding them. You question yourself, share your doubts, and to make it even worse, have the nerve to ask people to make their own decisions. You even on occasion admitted that you might be wrong, in capital letters. What on earth are you trying to do here? You must be aware that we, the public, are continually being infantilized by the media, the talking heads, and the politicians. We like it, and we are used to it. We are taught to hand over our lives, our rights, and our money to the experts, and also to be extremely grateful if they lose the lot or extract the wrong kidney. We're then expected to put our hand in our pocket all over again when we see their car salesman smile, and we do, in capitals. I think I speak for all your listeners when I say that all we really want is to be given a bunch of reassuring platitudes from anybody as long as they have the right haircut. We trust these people. Those full body cavity searches are for the good of us all. Desist! Your cousin's right. We're naive and we're too dumb to even know it. If you make us think, you're rocking the boat, and where would that leave the top 1% of our population who have done such a fantastic job of everything? Gotta go, American Idol's on. Tony. P.S. Thanks for saving me $50,000. Then comes Richard in seriousness. After listening to you and after our financial consultation with you, which I should not hesitate to recommend to any of your listeners, my wife and I sold all our stock holdings after listening to you. They are down over $50,000. We also moved our 401ks into money market funds, and they've gone up. We have watched this whole financial crisis unfold like two people at the opera with the program in their hands. None of this has been a surprise, and I have had absolutely zero anxiety, zero lost sleep, and zero panic about the whole thing. Not that we don't have concerns for the future, but we still have our money intact and therefore have more options. The time to learn how to control a car which skids out of control on a 30-degree hill in the ice is not when the first time you get in a car it's on a 30-degree hill in the ice. The info you have shared with us has helped us do the right thing. It's still in the garage. And then another piece called On Moving Countries. Personally, have lived in France, Germany, and the USA, native of England. Moving is challenging, but mainly challenging to the self. There are papers to fill in, apartments to find, schools to figure out if you have children, but those are the sorts of things we all deal with in our own countries. This isn't the challenging part. The challenging part is moving from the familiar to the unfamiliar. However, the unfamiliar does become familiar after time. Liken it to the first day at high school, the most daunting thing in the world at the time, but we all get through it. We are all quite robust and capable beings. We've been around for billions of years. We're just taught to fear. It's extremely enriching to be in a culture other than one's own. The language, though challenging, opens the mind because each language is a totally different way of thinking. The food, the tastes, smells, atmosphere, habits, even the dogs look and act differently. The weather is different, the clouds don't look the same. It gets really interesting, and one day you find that a lot of the programming you grew up with is just that. The people around you have cultural programs which are different from yours. You realize that one isn't right and the other wrong. They are just different, and you get a deeper understanding of people because you have brand new eyes to see it all. On the practical, everyone has to answer those questions for themselves. Why go anywhere? It might be that a skill you have is needed. It might be the climate. It might be that you have friends or family there. No size fits all. I would urge those who are considering moving abroad to be mindful, cautious, but fearless. Be judicious, though. I mean, don't take a truck driving job in Iraq. Sitting only with what's familiar is like wearing the same sweatpants for eternity. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Tony. We have all benefited hugely from your wisdom. Right. Well, we don't have any more callers, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about the current comparisons with the Great Depression. We've talked about it before. I would hasten to point out that the comparisons are limited. This is not the same as the Great Depression. It is actually far worse, as I've said on many occasions. The degree of trouble is orders of magnitude worse than during the Great Depression. In particular, of course, the debt situation is much more serious. The country is a debtor country, the United States, which it was not. was a creditor nation back in the late 20s, early 30s. But I did think that coming across an excerpt from the 1939 book Since Yesterday by Frederick Lewis Allen, I would read you a little part here, because I thought that it really brings home to me, at any rate, the kind of problems which come up, which one doesn't necessarily reflect that much on during the good times. So here goes. It's from Since Yesterday, a 1939 book by Frederick Lewis Allen. Intermittently, throughout the year 1933, the Senate Committee on Banking and Currency, with the aid of its inexorable counsel, Ferdinand Pecora, had been putting on one of the most extraordinary shows ever produced in a Washington committee room, a sort of protracted coroner's inquest upon American finance. One by one, a long line of financial overlords, commercial bankers, investment bankers, railroad and public utility holding company promoters, stockbrokers and big speculators, had filed up to the witness table, and from these unwilling gentlemen and from their office files had been extracted a sorry story of public irresponsibility and private greed. Day by day, this story had been spread upon the front pages of the newspapers. By the way, this reminds me of what happened in Congress the other day when the chief executive officers of the various big financial service companies were lined up birds on a perch, being questioned by ignorant people from Congress. It was really very disturbing to see that. But it was the same kind of thing. To continue, the investigation showed how pool operators in Wall Street had manipulated the price of stocks on the exchange with the assistance of men inside the companies with whose securities they toyed. It showed how they made huge profits, which represented the exercise of no socially useful function, at the expense of little speculators and of investors generally, and had fostered a speculative mania which had wrecked the whole economic system of the country, and this not only in 1928 and 29, but as recently as the spring of 1933, when Roosevelt was in the White House and Wall Street had supposedly been wearing the sackcloth and ashes of repentance. The investigation showed, too, how powerful bankers had unloaded stocks and bonds upon the unwary through high-pressure salesmanship and had made millions trading in the securities of their own banks at the expense of stockholders whose interests they claimed to be serving. It showed how the issuing of new securities had been so organized as to yield rich fruits to those on the inside, and how opportunities to taste these fruits had been offered to gentlemen of political influence. It showed how that modern engine of financial power, the holding company, had been misused by promoters, how some of these promoters had piled company upon company till their structures of corporate influence were 7 or 8 stories high, how these structures had become so complex that they were readily looted by unscrupulous men, and so unstable that many of them came crashing down during the Depression. It showed how grave could be the results when the holding company technique was applied to banking. It showed how men of wealth had used devices like the personal holding company and tricks like the sale of stock at a loss to members of their families to dodge the tax collector at the very moment when men of humbler station had been paying the taxes which supported the government. Again and again, it showed how men occupying fiduciary positions in the financial world had been false to their trust. Naturally, the composite picture blocked out by these revelations was not fair to the financiers generally. The worst scandals got the biggest headlines, yet the amount of black in the picture was shocking even to the most judicial observer, and the way in which the severity of the Depression had been intensified by greedy and short-sighted financial practices seemed blindingly plain. So high did the public anger mount that the New Deal was sure of strong support as it drove on to new measures of reform. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when you read the above excerpt, you realize how similar today is to what happened in the early 1930s. It is quite eerie, is it not? You know, the Great Depression showed how social and global chaos followed hard on economic collapse. The mere fact that parliaments across the globe, from America to Japan, are unable to make responsible, economically sound recovery plans suggests that they do not know what to do and are simply hoping for the least disruption. Equally worrisome is the adoption of more statist economic programs around the globe and the concurrent decline of trust in free market systems. Well, the threat of instability is clearly a pressing concern right now. You know, China was, until last year, the world's fastest growing economy. It just reported that 20 million migrant laborers lost their jobs. Even in the flush times of recent years, China faced upward of 70,000 labor uprisings a year. A sustained downturn poses grave and possibly immediate threats to Chinese internal stability. The regime in Beijing may be faced with a choice of repressing its own people or diverting their energies outward, leading to conflict with China's neighbors. Russia, an oil state completely dependent on energy sales, has had to put down riots in its Far East as well as in downtown Moscow. Vladimir Putin's rule has been predicated on squeezing civil liberties while providing economic largesse. If that devil's bargain falls apart, then wide-scale repression inside Russia, along with a continuing threatening posture towards Russia's neighbors, is frankly likely. Even apparently stable societies face increasing risk and the threat of internal or possibly external conflict. As Japan's exports have plummeted by nearly 50%, 1/3 of the country's prefectures have passed emergency economic stabilization plans. Hundreds of thousands of temporary employees hired during the first part of this decade are being laid off. Spain's unemployment rate is expected to climb to nearly 20% by the end of 2010. Spanish unions are already protesting the lack of jobs, and the specter of violence, as occurred in the 1980s, is haunting the country. Meanwhile, in Greece, workers have already taken to the streets. Europe as a whole will face dangerously increasing tensions between native citizens and immigrants, largely from poorer Muslim nations who have increased the labor pool in the past several decades. Spain itself has absorbed 5 million immigrants since 1999, while nearly 9% of Germany's residents have foreign citizenship, including almost 2 million Turks. The xenophobic labor strikes in the UK do not bode well for the rest of Europe. A prolonged global downturn, let alone a collapse, would dramatically raise tensions inside these countries. Couple that with possible protectionist legislation in the United States, unresolved ethnic and territorial disputes in all regions of the globe, and a loss of confidence that world leaders actually know what they're doing. The result may be a series of small explosions that coalesce into nothing less than a big bang. Okay, well, let's have a look at a couple more emails. And by the way, the call-in number, if you wish to follow on Daryl's and Steve's footsteps, is 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. We are standing by and ready to field your calls. Andy Celsius wrote in and said, this was over the weekend, with all the noise coming from the right wing about redistribution of the wealth, indeed Mr. Salenti points out that government control of corporate power is not socialism, but fascism. Would it not be reasonable to characterize what is happening as the redistribution of wealth from the working and middle classes to the wealthy class, also known as ruling? If not reasonable, then one can certainly expect many people pushed into unreasonable circumstances to find someone to blame for their situation. And I say this with the most solemn and regretful tone that I have read on YouTube and other places, comments pointing out that all persons close to this disaster are of Semitic extraction. The oral history within my family still recalls German society's descent into Nazism, which was also from a lofty place. The more things change, the more they stay the same, and every new generation seems doomed to prove it for themselves. May I offer the four immeasurables? May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness which is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from both attachment and hatred, holding someone close and others distant. Then he says, Andy, in another email just one day later, five reasons for economic optimism. One, the stock market is no longer overpriced. Two, the government is on the case. Three, consumers are adjusting to the new economic reality and fast. Four, reinvention and change are what the U.S. is all about. Five, okay, I couldn't think of a fifth reason. I also have to admit that as I look back at the first four reasons, they're all exercises in either A, finding silver linings in really bad news, or B, wishful thinking that has yet to be backed up with hard evidence. All the actual economic news at the moment is negative. There's no clear path out of the recession in sight, and optimists have been made to look like idiots for 2 years running. Happily, I was pessimistic for most of 2007 and 2008, maybe because economic columnists weren't as popular back then. It is, of course, exactly when the news is most discouraging and sentiment most gloomy that recoveries begin. But there's no way of knowing until after the fact when that moment of great pessimism was reached. That is true enough. That is absolutely true enough. A quick word on something that I tell you so frequently, ladies and gentlemen, which is that this wretched economic stimulus cannot possibly work. And what I really wanted to mention was a comment from Charles Minter, who's director and co-portfolio manager of Comstock Partners, which, by the way, puts out a monthly report which I feel you should all read. It's always good. Very frequently I quote from it in my email distribution list, so some of you will be familiar with Comstock. And he says, and I quote, "We really believe that we cannot be using government intervention in any manner, whether it's the banks, whether it's the automobile companies, whether it's virtually anything, the housing market especially. The housing market is so large right now. It was $21 trillion. It's now around $17 trillion. We really can't see how it's possible to stop a $17 trillion market from reaching its fair value by intervening for $75 billion or $150 billion. Minter points out a $21 trillion housing market is not going to be affected much by a bailout of several hundred billion dollars, and that's certainly true. That is why I always tell people to focus on the top-level securitization, not the details at the bottom. All the Washington officials, even including Ben Bernanke, talk about solving some particular point problem, such as saving a bank or building a bridge. When you look at the entire problem from the top down, $1 quadrillion in credit derivatives, according to the Bank of International Settlements, you realize how hopeless the problem is. Now, did you get that, ladies and gentlemen? That's $1 quadrillion in credit derivatives. We've already seen many structured securities fall in value by 70 to 80% from their notional value as the credit bubble breaks. If the $1 quadrillion in credit derivative fall by only 5%, then that's $50 trillion in losses. There is no bailout or stimulus that can even make a dent in $50 trillion worth of losses. People always ask how I can be so certain that the bottom hasn't been reached or that there's much worse to come. And when you look at the top-level aggregates, it's perfectly clear. That's the point that Minter is making about the housing market. Instead of focusing on various plans to stop foreclosures or lower mortgage interest rates or provide mortgage money to banks or whatever, just look at the size of the market, $21 trillion, and you know immediately that nothing can work. It's fine to look at the details, but if you want to understand why a financial crisis must occur, then you have to focus on the size of the securitization. I mean, let's just look at the five previous international financial crises and see that they all have securitization of credit in common. The 1637 Tulipomania bubble was based on a market in tulip futures securitized with personal credit notes. The 1721 South Sea bubble was securitized by shares of the South Sea Company, a company operating in South America. The 1789-95 bankruptcy of the French monarchy was securitized by assignats, which were bills of credit based on lands confiscated from the clergy. The panic of 1857 was securitized by railway shares, and the 1929 Wall Street crash was securitized by stock shares and by phony securities that turned out to be worthless. So you see, securitization is the common theme in all generational panics and crashes. It's the main feature of the current one. And once you understand how securitization is used and how little the people in Washington understand it, then you will understand how much trouble this country is in. You know, the Obama administration's housing plan, which will pay banks to lower monthly payments for troubled borrowers, seeks to avert millions of foreclosures and keep more homes occupied. But unfortunately, that is exactly the wrong approach to take, because it will only delay but not stop the inevitable decline in prices, which needs to occur in order to jumpstart the market and thereby only serve to prolong the housing crisis. One way or another, the prices of homes in the majority of areas across the U.S. are bound to fall further, especially in big city areas like New York and San Francisco, which have so far seen only modest declines. Many more foreclosures will inevitably come onto the market. But you see, falling prices are a good thing because they will bring needed buyers back into the market. And there's nothing radical about this idea. Prices simply need to fall to the point where they can stimulate demand. The amount of decline needed is likely to be the level where the monthly cost of owning becomes cheaper than renting, which for many areas represents about a cumulative 40% peak-to-trough decrease. See, the main flaw with the administration's plan is that the modification program does not involve principal write-downs or a way to firewall prices from declining further. Therefore, many borrowers are likely to re-default for two reasons. First of all, they will remain underwater on their principal even after payment modifications are made. Because house prices in the vast majority of areas are highly likely to keep declining, many of these modified borrowers are going to find themselves going further into negative equity and therefore into re-default. It makes no financial sense for borrowers to keep paying the mortgage on an underwater property when they can rent for less than the monthly cost of carrying the mortgage on a losing investment, which is currently the case in the vast majority of areas. The FDIC, which designed the basic modification template that the government will be using, found that loans they modified in their Indy Mac portfolio had a 35% re-default rate within 6 months. A report, by the way, from the Comptroller of the Currency found a 50% re-default rate. These loans did not have their principals written down, but were modified with a combination of lowered interest rates and or extended payment terms. The important thing to remember about those numbers is that they were published last fall before the losses in jobs began to sharply accelerate, which brings us to the second reason the Obama plan will only prolong the housing crisis. With job losses now intensifying, i.e. 2.6 million of the total 4.4 million jobs lost since the start of the recession just in the last 4 months alone, and with employers cutting back on hours worked, many of these modified borrowers will see their incomes decline, putting further upward pressure on re-default rates. And there you have it. Let's take another question from Tracy. Hi, Richard. My question is, should I refinance my mortgage for a better rate or stay put? I have never been late on my payments. My FICO score is 804 as of last month, and my current rate is 6.375%. Tracy from Baltimore. Tracy, the answer is yes, I think you should refi, but I think you should wait for even lower mortgage rates if you really are looking to refi. The expenses involved would make it reasonable, in my opinion, for you to wait another year and a half to do that. And then I think that if you are still paying and you're okay with paying the mortgage according to the current terms, yes, you should refi at that point. Okay. All right. We have a comment from Mike Reidinger, who says, Richard, any comment on the FDIC announcement of a big bank falling? U.S. CD owners are on our tiptoes. Thank you, Mike R. Mike, I actually think that you'll be okay. I think that the FDIC are serious when they say that they will cover money in the bank. They have an open line, I've forgotten how many billion, it could be 50 billion, I think, from the Treasury, in case they run out of money, and they can always go back for more. And I believe that the government feels that bank deposits are a high priority, and therefore the FDIC will be made whole and will receive the funds with which to pay. So I am not concerned about the FDIC. There was even a program, a comment on 60 Minutes last night, Michael, about that. Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, was actually quite firm about that, and I think that what I get from it is that they are serious about making people whole on their bank holdings. So I think you're okay, not to worry. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we're down to 30 seconds right now. Luciano Polo asked about gold, whether my opinion had explicitly changed. It actually hasn't, Luciano, so not to worry. Stay away from gold for the time being. If I feel my opinion changes, I will let you know. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful week. I will be back on Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern. Until then, bye-bye for now.